You're listening to Science Friday from NPR. I'm Ira Flatow. Up next, happy birthday, SETI. For those of you who haven't seen the movie Contact, or those of you who already know what SETI means, it stands for the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. And 50 years ago, the first experiment to try and make contact with intelligent life on other planets was launched. That experiment, dubbed Project OSMA, looked for radio signals coming in from two stars, and it paved the way for a much more massive effort to find alien life. Those efforts are still underway at the SETI Institute in Mountain View, California, and in programs like the SETI at Home Project that is run out of UC Berkeley. The man who conducted the first experiment turns 80 this year, and coincidentally, the SETI Institute turns 25. So to celebrate, the SETI Institute is throwing a party. SETICON gets underway today. It's a three-day event, all things extraterrestrial. Boy, I'd like to see the costumes that must be showing up at that party. Joining me now to talk more about SETI and SETICON are my guests, Frank Drake, who conducted the first modern SETI experiment in 1960. He's a member of the Board of Trustees and Chairman Emeritus of the SETI Institute. He joins us from Mountain View. Thanks for talking with us today, Dr. Drake.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
Thank you. Also with us is Jill Tarter. She is Director of the Center for SETI Research. If you've seen Contact, the Jodie Foster character is based on Dr. Tarter. Welcome back to Science Friday.
Hi there, Ira.
Hey there.
Good to be back.
Also, welcome back from Andrew Fracknoy. He's a trustee of the SETI Institute and one of the organizers of SETICON. He's chair of the astronomy program at Foothill College in Los Altos Hills. Welcome back, Andrew.
Nice to be with you again.
Nice to have you. Seth Shostak is also an organizer of SETICON and a senior astronomer at the Institute. Thanks for being with us today, Dr. Shostak.
It's a pleasure, Ira.
Let me first talk to Frank Drake about that experiment 50 years ago. What made you think back then that you could find evidence of intelligent life if you searched for it?
Well, I had been fascinated with the idea that there was intelligent life in space for many, many years at that point. And I had constantly been looking for reasonable ways by which we might find it. And nothing was reasonable until about 1957, when we were building the first large radio telescopes in this country, and some very much improved, more sensitive radio receivers had been invented. And if one just did the calculations of the strength of signal that could be detected with the combination of the new telescope and the radio receiver, it turned out to be a signal no stronger than we were then ourselves transmitting into space. And so it seemed reasonable to search because we didn't have to assume some super civilization or something like that. They just had to be like us, and we could find them. And so we proceeded.
Uh-huh. In fact, what you're talking about, if I remember correctly, are signals that escape our own broadcast. I think the famous Carl Sagan worked with you, used to talk about I Love Lucy escaping out into space, and people would be, not judging us by what we watched on television, but at least tuning in on our signals, and that's the kind of stuff you were looking for?
That's the kind of stuff, although that stuff is not as easy to detect as some other things, such as our radar systems.
Uh-huh.
That's what we could have detected back in 1960. Today, we still are not able to detect our own television broadcasts, but a civilization slightly more advanced than us could do that.
Uh-huh. And you created an equation back then, which still bears your name, that's used to estimate the potential number of extraterrestrial civilizations in our galaxy, the Milky Way, known as the Frank Drake equation.
Yes, it's an equation which gives us an estimate of the number of detectable civilizations there are in our galaxy. And what it does is to quantify all of our understanding about the history of a planetary system using our own system as a model, how planets form, what the variety of planets might be in a system, what planets might give rise to life, and then taking into account the probability that life arises and intelligence arises and actually a detectable technology is developed. A crucial factor in it is the length of time that a civilization remains detectable. We have been detectable for about 50 years, but that's one of the great unknowns, which means that we can really use this equation only as a very crude guide as to how difficult our search is, but it's a start.
Mm-hmm. Jill Tarter, you're very serious in this work. I mean, people look at you sometimes and may say, oh, we're never going to find this stuff. But you take this very seriously, don't you?
Oh, I certainly do. And I get up every morning and try and figure out how to do it better today than we did yesterday.
And how would you like to improve the way you're looking?
Well, we have a telescope that we're building with the University of California, Berkeley. It's called the Allen Telescope Array because Paul Allen funded the technology development and first phase of construction. That telescope now has 42 antennas. We'd like to grow it to 350. But now that we have our own telescope, we can also do something else. We can bring the world in and let the world help us make the search better. SETI at Home for 10 years has been allowing people to leave their computers turned on and crunch data in kind of a service mode. But we'd like to take that to the next step. We'd like to allow people to creatively get involved to help us build better search algorithms, maybe even to use their eyeballs to find patterns in noise. But seems to me that playing up the silicon piece of the search, that is the compute power, is the way to go right now.
You mean sort of making an open source search for everybody to get involved?
Open SETIQuest. We've started a community called SETIQuest, and there are many ways that people who are technically capable in writing code or in signal processing can help. Those that don't have those technical skills can help as citizen scientists.
Mm-hmm. Is the basic approach the same, though, as when it was started 50 years ago?
Well, Frank started looking at stars that are like the sun. That's a good guess. Mm-hmm. We're continuing that. My list of stars has 250,000 rather than Frank's original two. But in addition, we're also doing a survey of the direction on the sky around the center of the galaxy, because in 20 square degrees in that direction, there are billions and billions of stars. They're all far away, so the transmitters we would be able to detect would have to be more powerful than the ones we have today. But we've never done that search, and it takes out the biases of thinking we know where to look.
And what would an intelligent life signal look like to you? How would you know you're getting it? And
well,
what frequency range, things like that, to even search in?
We use a frequency range in the radio, which is a clear window on the universe that's set by physics. At lower frequencies, below a gigahertz, 1,000 megahertz, the universe or our galaxy gets very loud because of synchrotron radiation, electrons spinning around the magnetic fields in our galaxy. At frequencies above 10 gigahertz, it suddenly gets noisy because of the oxygen and water vapor in our own atmosphere. But 1 to 10 is a clear window. That's where we're looking in the radio. We're also looking in the optical. We're also using detectors that look for very bright light pulses that only last a billionth of a second or less. In both cases, we're looking for engineered signals as opposed to astrophysical signals. In the radio, we're looking for frequency compression, that's narrowband signals. And in the optical, we're looking for time compression, these very short pulses.
Do you ever worry about interference from microwave ovens and cell phones? Because they're right in that frequency range, aren't
they? That's right. We are our own worst enemies, which is why we put so much work into being able to do our signal detection in real time or near real time so that when a signal is found, we can follow up on it immediately. Mm-hmm. Using multiple telescopes, multiple beams on the sky simultaneously also is a good mitigation scheme that we're using. Yes, deciding whether the technology we detect is ours or theirs is a big problem.
Mm-hmm. Frank Drake, there were people who had suggested years ago that we should not only be listening, but instead of just sending out our radar signals, we should be sending out our own coded intelligence signals. What's your view on that?
Well, I have a view on it. Those things are suggested because it seems only fair. If we're searching for signals from them, we should be reciprocating by sending signals to them. But to me, it isn't necessary because we already send a multitude of signals in the form of our television, our radar signals, and such. we have made our presence known. The Earth is surrounded by a huge shell full of our signals, which stretches out more than 50 light years now. Thousands of stars have received our television programs, our radar signals and such. And for us to transmit something in addition to this would be simply adding a little bit of frosting on an already very large cake. And I think our resources are better spent in searching than in frosting a cake.
Seth Shostak, as organizer of SETICON, I'm wondering if you, among the people who are coming, are people who might wonder, what do you do if you find? How do you get your mind around actually finding intelligent life?
Well, certainly, Ira, there are many people who have an opinion about what would happen if we were to pick up a signal, say, tomorrow night.
Right.
And most of those people seem to think that the government would suddenly swoop down on the institute and on the observatory and shut it all down. I don't know why they have this conspiratorial view of the government, but they do.
It happens in the movies that way.
It always has. They send in these men in black. And I figure if the government could really afford those guys in black, then they could afford to, you know, contribute to the construction of our instruments here. But in fact, we really do know what's going to happen because we've had false alarms. These are perfectly good tests of what's really going to happen. And I can assure you, we had a false alarm in 1997 that for, you know, most of the day looked like it might be the real deal. Mm. It turns out it was due to a technical fault. But the reason that it occurred is not interesting. What's interesting is that it showed what happens. And what happens is that the New York Times starts calling up. The media are on it right away. So the idea that it would be secret, I mean, that's nonsense. Of course, in terms of the long-term effect, that depends on whether we could decode the message.
1-800-989-8255 is the number. Andrew Fracknoy, I understand that one of your speakers at SETICON is going to address something called cosmophobia. What is that, Andrew?
Well, Ira, let's tell our listeners a little bit about SETICON. It's going to be, as you said so nicely, a party, but also a chance to learn a lot from scientists, from science fiction writers, from thinkers in many fields about how we address these large-scale questions. If any of your listeners are in Northern California, it's going to be this weekend in Santa Clara. And one of the things that we want to talk about is this new kind of fear of the sky, cosmophobia. There's been a lot of talk of 2012 being the end of the world. And the good news there is you wouldn't have to pay taxes in 2013. But the bad news would be that everything else would stop, too. And there's absolutely no evidence for that. The notion that somehow a planet predicted by the ancient Sumerians is coming into the solar system and no one's yet aware of it, or that the sun is going to act up in a way that it never has before because it's the end of some count of the Mayan calendar. These are the kind of folk myths that are all over the web. And part of what we hope to do at SETICON is to set the record straight, to talk a little bit rationally about these issues, and to show that most of what's going on in the universe is actually more interesting than dangerous.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. You can also tweet us at SciFry, at SCIFRI, talking about the SETICON and SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, on Science Friday from NPR. I'm Ira Flatow, talking with Frank Drake and Jill Tarter and Seth Shostak and Andrew Fracknoy. And I actually understand that people are so serious about this that NASA has assigned a full-time person just to answer questions about this.
About 2012, yes.
Yeah, that's amazing.
David Morrison. It's not full-time. He's actually also a senior staff member at the SETI Institute.
Right.
But part of what he does, part of his passion, is to help the public understand these things. And he will be there along with Phil Plait, the bad astronomer who often debunks bad astronomy in movies. And I also will be talking about this whole 2012 business and also other things, the so-called face on Mars, claims that aliens already coming here, all of which is more mythology than real science. But what it does is it shows the tremendous public interest in this question of whether or not we're alone.
Well, let me see if I can get a quick question before we have to go to the break. Let's go to Jeff in Montclair, Virginia. Hi, Jeff.
Hi. Hey, thanks for taking my call. First, I just want to say I'm very skeptical that there is really extraterrestrial life. I'll start out with that. But beyond that, Dr. Hawkins said recently, was quoted as saying that if there is extraterrestrial life, we should leave it alone. We shouldn't try and find them, because if they're more intelligent than us, it could wreak havoc on our society. So I just want to know if that's an issue you guys consider or what.
Let me get a reaction. Jill, what do you think about that?
Well, if in fact they can get here, then they are more technologically advanced than we are. As Frank already pointed out, we've already let that cat out of the bag. We've announced our presence. And if they're more technologically advanced, if they've gotten old enough to get that advancement, I think they've solved the kinds of problems that lead to the aggression that we're still dealing with as an emerging technology.
Mm-hmm. Frank Drake, you want to jump in there?
No, what Jill said is right. And more than that, we have been in a way bamboozled by science fiction. Science fiction is wonderful. It excites our imagination. But if you get serious about it and just look into the realities of what it takes to travel to another star, to exploit its resources, you find out that there is nothing we have that is worth the cost that it would take to go get it and take it home. And so exploiting other civilizations, which works well on Earth, does not work in the cosmos, because the great distances between the stars creates a cosmic quarantine. We cannot harm each other, but we can help each other.
Surely you must have put some thought to what other life might look like, Frank.
Well, there are things you can say about that. One thing is that they will not be identical to us. The course of evolution, the various steps which led to our exact anatomy, physiology, will not be repeated. On the other hand, I like to say we're a good design, and so a lot of them may resemble us. Standing upright is very useful because you have limbs free to manipulate tools, which is necessary if you're to have technology. The head needs to be on top for self-defense, to gather food and such. The eyes need to be in the head so that there's a short nerve pathway to the brain. And so basically we're an optimized design for a creature that lives on a planet like the Earth. And so this makes me think that in many cases, but certainly not in all or even in the majority, if we saw the extraterrestrials at a distance of 100 yards in the twilight, we might think they were humans. But when we got close, we'd know for sure, nope, those are not like us at all.
All right, we're going to take a quick break and come back and talk lots more about the search for extraterrestrial intelligent life. Our number, 1-800-998-2255. Tweet us, please, at SciFry, at SCIFRI. We'll be right back after this break. You're listening to Science Friday from NPR. I am Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about SETI, the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. It's been going on for a long time now, 50 years, 20 years. It's going way back. And with us, we have a panel of experts, Frank Drake, Jill Tarter, Andrew Fracknoy, Seth Shostak. I want to bring in now Dave Anderson, who is in charge of the SETI at Home. Since 1998, he has directed SETI at Home. That's a volunteer computing project. Welcome to Science Friday. David, are you there?
I'm here.
Good to hear from you. Is SETI at Home continuing? How many participants do you have involved in the project now?
Well, first I should say that SETI at Home is one of a group of complementary projects at Berkeley. We're also looking for laser flashes in the optical. And we have a couple of radio SETI searches. One is called Serendip. It's looking at a very broad frequency range. What SETI at Home does is it looks at a much narrower range, about 2.5 megahertz, mm-hmm. and does a very exhaustive search looking for all different types of signals. We've been running for about 10 years now, and we're still going. Currently, we have about 200,000 users, 300,000 PCs, and they provide us with the equivalent of a very powerful supercomputer.
Did you say you're looking for laser flashes? Is that correct? Did I hear you say
that? That's a different SETI project, mm-hmm. Also at UC Berkeley. SETI at Home is looking in the radio spectrum. It's what's called a sky survey, meaning that we record data from the Arecibo telescope as it scans the sky repeatedly over a long period of time. So we're not looking at individual stars. We're looking at the entire sky that's visible from Arecibo.
Are you still looking for new volunteers to join?
Definitely.
How do they sign up?
Well, you can just Google SETI, and you'll find us, or you can go to setiathome.berkeley.edu.
Have you ever had any promising results that you say we need to take a second look at what we found?
Well, our strategy is to accumulate a big database of signals over years, and then try to find signals coming from a particular point in the sky at about the same frequency, but at several different times. This is a way to get rid of radio frequency interference, which right. Jules mentioning. And so far, we've done one pass of that. We went down and reobserved our top 200 candidates at Arecibo, and we're gearing up to do that again. There were a couple of interesting signals in our database, but on reexamination, they weren't actually there in the sky.
Yeah. All right. Dave Anderson, thanks for joining us. Good luck to you and SETI at home.
Thanks a lot. Bye.
David Pete Anderson is director of SETI at home and talking about their efforts to look for the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. Also with me is Frank Drake, Jill Tarter, Andrew Fracknoy, and Seth Shostak. Our number 1-800-989-8255. Frank, how will you know if Dave Anderson gets a real hit? How will you know? What will it say? What should you be looking for?
Well, it may not say anything. It may be, for instance, a radar signal, which is mm-hmm. Could be a series of pulses. But we can be sure that we can identify very conclusively a technological origin of a signal, because there are certain characteristics of such signals that nature does not imitate or use. For example, the signal could well be confined to a very narrow bandwidth, much narrower than nature creates. It could be highly polarized. In fact, we expect both of those characteristics to be present. It will also be modulated. That puts information on the signal, and the radar itself is a form of a modulated signal. So there are three characteristics that just don't occur in nature that we could expect in any intelligent signal, and that will make it, I think, very easy to reach a conclusion as to whether or not a signal is of technological origin.
Jill Tarter, what if the creatures, the intelligent life out there, have a different philosophy about how to send out intelligent signals, or it's a search for their own? What if they believe that instead of listening to our random radio waves and radar, that they think that they should be listening for a signal that is specially created to send out a beacon that we are here, and they send one of those out themselves? Would we be able to detect that?
Well, if it's at radio or optical wavelengths, we should. When we detect a signal, we don't know whether it is leakage radiation or intended for us. Uh-huh. We only measure the fact that we receive the power and can look for the information in the signal. If, in fact, they're using some other technology that we haven't yet invented, well, there isn't a lot we can do about that except stick around as a species long enough to invent that technology and then start using it. As my colleague Seth is fond of saying, Columbus didn't wait for a 747 to get across the Atlantic. He used the technologies that he had at hand, and they turned out to be adequate in his case. We're a very young technology in a very old galaxy. We are probably the youngest technology in the galaxy that can participate in this kind of an exploration. We should expect them to be older. They may be using ancient instruments for them for the purposes of attracting the emerging technologies. That's ourselves.
If they were using visual signals, what kind of visual signals would we be looking for, or what would be strong enough for us to detect from that?
Well, if you used a laser, and as Frank has already said, if it's the petawatt kind of lasers that we've already developed on this planet as part of the National Ignition Facility, and you flashed those lasers for a billionth of a second with a lot of power and used a reasonable-sized telescope to focus that would be a very detectable signal across thousands of light years.
But that's what I'm saying is assuming that that's not just a random laser beam. That's something that has to be focused through a telescope and not the random kind of signal Frank was talking about, but something that they want us to find.
Well, beacons are certainly the easiest thing to find because somebody's gone to some trouble to make them detectable.
1-800-989-8255 is our number if you'd like to become involved. Go ahead. Somebody wants to jump in.
This is Andy. I was just going to say that that there are a lot of interesting speculations that people have done over the years of why exactly the aliens might be sending something to us. My favorite is that there's a seventh grade science project on some advanced alien planet, and they decide to use some older technology to see if they can get in touch with a civilization like ours. That's... or that there might be some betting going on between different bases of two different civilizations, and we're overhearing them laying down their bets. We're not in any way prejudiced about what kind of message we're looking for. If we can overhear any sign of intelligence at all, that, I think, will be the pivotal moment we're looking for.
Well, but Seth, you know, there are some people who believe that we've already been visited by a planet, by other beings who have left signals behind or some evidence behind that we're, you know, we've yet to find or just don't recognize or don't believe.
I hear from those people every day, Ira. I get emails and phone calls from people having difficulties with aliens in their personal lives on a daily basis. It's not a fringe belief. A third of the population, and this has been true for a half century, by the way, a third of the population believes indeed that the aliens are not just out there, but they are here. And, you know, a lot of this is, I mean, the people that call me up have seen something. And the question is not whether they have seen something. The question is, what have they seen? Look, the bottom line is this. I mean, how many times do you go down to the local airport and you're sitting in the plane, you know, at the gate, and the captain comes on and says, well, folks, we're going to be a little bit delayed here because there's some unidentified craft in the area that haven't filed a flight plan with the FAA. And consequently, we're not going to take off until they've left the city. You know, that doesn't happen to you very often. Mm-hmm. I think that if we were being visited, it would not be the subject of late-night talk radio discussion. It would be something that would be stacked up at the American Museum of Natural History or at the Smithsonian, and it would be the subject of study by tens of thousands of academics around the world.
1-800-989-8255 is the number. Last question to you, Jill. In this era of tight money, how do you keep a project funded like this going?
Well, we are in the philanthropic era of SETI since 1993. We are the beneficiaries of private support, very generous support from people who think that what we're doing is important for humanity, and we hope that that support continues. But it is a big problem.
Well,
raising money.
You funded it yourself from your TED Prize winnings, did you not?
I certainly, the TED community offered me a prize, and that prize went right into the search, certainly. And that it is nonetheless, it's a lot of money to raise privately or one person raising, but it isn't a lot of money in the larger context. We're talking about a project that needs a few million dollars a year to keep running and growing and doing extraordinary new things. Mm-hmm. And after all, it's a project that might in fact answer one of the oldest questions in humanity. Are we alone? And I certainly think it's worth it.
Mm-hmm. And we have a very interesting SETI video up on our website where I can call it a remix. Is that correct?
Yes.
Well, can you briefly describe it?
We have 20 research experience for undergraduate students here this summer. Actually, they're just leaving this week, and they spent their last weekend making a remarkable video called SETI Girls, G-U-R-L-S, which indicates that doing science seriously, dealing with the questions of life in the universe and the potential for life somewhere else can also be a lot of fun.
If you go to our website at sciencefriday.com and click on this program segment, you can see the SETI girls. It reminds me of the one made by the Large Hadron Collider physicists in
Ira, in maybe as long as we're talking about websites, we can mention that the SETICon event this weekend does have a website that listeners can go to. It's SETICon.com, and there they have all the information about how to get there and what the program is, and we very much welcome your listeners to either come if they can in person or to go to the SETI website later on and learn all about the things we were discussing.
All right, Andrew, thank you for summing up for us. Andrew Fracknoy is chair of the astronomy program at Foothill College in Los Altos Hills, California. Also with us is Seth Chostak. He is a senior astronomer at the SETI Institute. Jill Tarter, director of the Center for SETI Research at the SETI Institute, and Frank Drake, who conducted the first modern SETI experiment in 1960. He is a member of the Board of Trustees and Chairman Emeritus of the Institute. Good luck to you all this weekend on the SETICON conference. Wish you the best of luck there. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you,
Ira.
You're welcome.